Hey, what's going on there, CNFers? Thanks for listening. I've been jamming out to Metallica's new record all day, so I can't really hear the words I'm saying. Anyway, so we're back with the hopes of making Friday a regularity to give you a nice little pop of CNF for the weekend. With that in mind, I've got Pete Croato, freelancer extraordinaire, and this is a good one because that's all we talk about. Pete shares what he's learned in his 10 years of freelancing, so it's a great little playbook if you're thinking about getting into the ring. He wrote a blog post about the 10 things he wished he knew when he started 10 years ago. You'll find that in the show notes. So, subscribe to the podcast, my newsletter over at brendanomero.com, and enjoy Pete. Definitely one of the good guys. This is it. Episode 29. Hit it. Did it take to you to come to those sort of that list of revelations, if you will?
How long did it take? I would say 10 years. and again, you know, I'm always learning, and yeah. I'm always, you know, every day. I mean, I don't want to sound dramatic, but you know, if you're not learning in this business, if you're not making mistakes and learning from them, you're really not doing this job very well. So, I mean, and that's the thing. I could have easily put maybe 50 observations, and if in a month or so, I could probably have another 10 things that I just learned. So, and part of that is because you really are running a business. I mean, there's the writing element to it, and there's getting better at that, which is a whole territory. But then you are running a business, you are dealing with marketing, you're dealing with accounting, you're dealing with paperwork, and it's a whole. So every day there is something new. I mean, or just about every day. So yeah. So in 10 years, I might have 1,000 tips. Then. Yeah. But 10 seemed like a good place to start. And those seemed like the things that really plagued me when I was the 10 things I wish I had known when I started in 2006.
So what were the circumstances that pushed you towards this freelancing leap that you took 10 years ago?
That's a good question. All right. Well, I don't know. Do you want the long story? Do you want the short story? It can go on.
I love long stories. So
okay,
go yeah, for the origin story.
So all right. So in 2006, in November 2006, I was working at a company, a trade magazine publisher, and they're still in existence, called VRM Inc., which stands for Vitamin Retailer Magazine Inc. And I was an associate editor at the time. I had started off as an assistant editor in 2003, and this is in March of 2003. So I'd been there for almost 4 years, and it was the kind of job, as I explained in the post, that really it should have been a job that I was there at for maybe 2 years tops. Because it was a great job, because you learned so much. I mean, you were thrown into the thick of things, and you learned how to write long form or longer stories. You learned how to deal with sources. You learned how to keep a schedule. A lot of valuable things that I think a lot of journalism students maybe don't learn the first time around. So I was at this job, and year one was fine. Year two was okay. By the time I got to year three, I was burnt out. It was a lot of work. It was an editorial staff of three putting out 28 issues a year, writing, reporting. And on top of that, you know, I'm doing administrative tasks. I'm answering the phones. I'm ordering office supplies. Hmm. It was a gothic amount of work. And in doing the job, I just felt like I wasn't challenged. And I felt, you know, I'm almost 30. It is in 2006, and I feel like I'm leaving a lot on the table. I mean, I'm writing these stories, and they're, you know, I'm not really learning anything new. I'm not challenging myself. I'm not getting better. And there are so many things that I'm interested in that I'm not getting a chance to write about, because I'm working 10, 11 hour days. So So I just started to get really depressed, and I started to get really out of it. And I thought, you know, I have to make a change. So it was a risk. And I decided, you know what, I have to freelance because I don't want to wake up 10 years from now or 5 years from now and think, gee, you know, what could I have done? You know, why didn't I do this? Why didn't I write this? So I don't know. It's a very long winded answer, but it really was a matter of, when it comes right down to it, I wasn't happy. And leaving seemed like the best chance to save myself and to do the kind of writing that I wasn't doing.
And I think an important point you made in your blog post too was, mm-hmm. as you decided to jump, you put in your 2 weeks notice on the 1st of November,
yep.
you jumped in and freelance, but you also had the side gig of working at Borders as well,
yep.
which is, I think, real important to even for people who want to do that, it's always good to have something steady on the side, whether it's working 10, 20, 30. It's sometimes having that sort of a side gig of that nature that's steady, but also doesn't take up a whole lot of your sort of mental RAM as you're looking to do other projects. So I wonder, like, if you could speak to the importance of having that other side gig as well.
Oh, it was hugely important, and you touched on a lot of what made that important. Why it's important, from just the boring, practical adult point of view, it was health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very expensive, and it's still expensive. So that was clutch to get health insurance. It was important to get a steady source of income every month to pay basic bills and to pay expenses, because those don't go away. And you're right. It was great to go. It was really important to interact with other people and to just be out in the world and not be confined to a desk or confined to a computer waiting for emails to come in. So it was fantastic. I absolutely love working at Borders because there were just so many characters there. And that's the thing too. Like, as a writer, you know, and I don't care if you're writing novels or press releases or articles on municipal meetings. I think every writer is fascinated by people and is fascinated by just what happens, in the flow of life. And Borders was amazing. There were so many people there that were just, first of all, my coworkers were amazing, and I got exposed to different viewpoints, and I got exposed to different lifestyles. I met all sorts of people from different walks of life, grandmothers and hipsters and you know, college students and folks like me that were just trying to make a buck. And they were all readers, and they were all passionate about reading. And that was inspiring. And it was great to work in a place where you were surrounded by books. And it was an impetus to read more. It was an impetus to learn more. But just the daily shot of humanity that came through those doors was incredible. Like, we had so many characters that were it was like Cheers. They were right. They would just come in. There was one guy that would go in buy a cup of coffee. There were free refills. He would refill the cup of coffee, and he would stay there for 8 hours just wandering around the store. Like that, there was that guy. I mean, there were people there that were just really nice and just were, that's how they spent their days. But there were so many. It was such a melting pot that was just such a breath of fresh air, especially after coming from a job where you were with the same five people day after day after day. And
yeah.
it also was a nice break from writing, and it kept me among the living. I don't know if that makes any sense, but when you write, and I've been victim to this, I'm sure you have as well, you tend to get caught up in the same routines. You get wrapped up in a story, you get wrapped up in interviews, you get wrapped up in just trying to keep things going, that you forget that there's a whole world out there. And Borders, aside from providing me with income and friends who I'm still in contact with, and amazing stories and friendships, it also got me outside of the house, and that was clutch. I mean, I'm not sure how long it would have lasted if I had just been chained to my desk for 8 hours a day. It probably wouldn't have ended well. I probably wouldn't be talking to you.
Yeah, absolutely. It totally helps to get it forces you out into the world in that sense, because it just kind of, it's real easy to get bogged down to be in the same corner in your apartment or your house.
Yes.
And it just, it does, it kind of, it sort of recharges you. I mean, it's not like that ideal of, oh yeah, like my writing is supporting me 100%. And it, like, I think that's this gold standard that you think, you know, when you get into it, like, oh yeah, I want my writing and my words and everything and my pitches to sustain me. But it's, in a lot of ways, like a side gig of this nature is almost, it should almost be required reading, if you will, to have that, because it forces you to have to socialize, which is so important just for mental health.
Absolutely right. And you also learn that there are people out in the world besides you. You know, we, especially with Twitter and Facebook and all this social media, it's so easy to get lost in your own little village that you cultivate, and you're with people that think like you and talk like you, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's fantastic. But you're right. Going out and seeing other people, dealing with different people every day, I think it's definitely a requirement. Because you learn that the world is not just you and your computer and your own thoughts. There are people that think differently than you. There are people that act differently than you, look differently than you. I mean, what I'm saying sounds very elementary, but you forget that so easily, especially if you're so wrapped up in your own little world with your projects and your gigs. So yeah, and that's why now I try to get outside once a day. I try to, you know, I'll go food shopping, I'll go to the gym, I'll because those things remind me that there's a larger world out there, and you know, it's not just you.
And how many hours a week were you working at the Borders?
Oh wow, I was putting in, I would say 40 hours a week. I was putting in 40 hours a week, and then writing when I could. So I was pitching on my off days. And the thing is, the off days were always, there was always at least one weekday. So there was a Monday or a Tuesday. So I was reviewing movies at the time. So I'd go in and review movies. I would work on pitches. I would write stuff. And then I would squeeze that in between shifts of Borders. And, it was funny. It didn't feel nearly as exhausting as it probably sounds, because I felt like I was doing this on my, I felt like I was living on my own terms. I was working on my own terms, and that was very energizing.
You almost see like those jobs of that nature. If you use a little sort of mental kung fu, you can kind of trick yourself into thinking like, well, this is my, these people are actually like paying me to write. I'm just putting in put a little time. It's like a book advance. It's like that's the, you know, those, that's my, they're giving me the permission. I just have to put in some time here, and then I have to make some elsewhere. But it's like you figure that's your revenue stream to really sort of fund what you really want to be doing.
No, absolutely right. I think a lot of writers do that now. You know, there are things that they work on that they have to work on, and you're thankful for the work and you do the best job that you can, but you have those dream projects or you have those passion projects that are filed away that you work on your spare time. And you're absolutely right. It was the same thing here, you know, and Borders, it's a shame they closed, because it was, I'm going to sound like I'm Borders PR. That was probably the best non-writing job I've ever had. I mean, the hours were bonkers and the pay was not great, but they let you take out whatever books you want. They you know, you could borrow magazines with impunity. You were working with people who were just like you, who love books, who love music, who love movies, and it was, you know, you get inspired working with people like that. You get inspired with people who work with passion, and that's, and it doesn't matter if they're bookstore employees or they're garbage men or whatever. I mean, that passion rubs off. And so it was always fun to go work at Borders. It was always fun. And then to come back and then to write when you have on the time off, it was glorious. I felt like I was stealing money. And I think that's sort of the sign that you're doing what you want to do, is that you 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 say to yourself, you're paying me for this? Like, you're paying me to recommend books and to flirt with customers at the register? Great. Yeah. I'll do that. It was great. And I actually wrote about it for Publishers Weekly. I wrote about how working at a bookstore was a life-changing experience, and it really was. And you know, you never know what paths work for you until you take them. And I'm glad I took that path. I really am.
I wonder why people aren't more inclined to, especially freelancers, because I never really hear it very often, hear them discuss the side jobs or the menial jobs that help sort of fund what they really want to do. Even if they're doing really great work and it doesn't pay for everything right away, it seems like there's this sort of, I don't know, a latent shame to have to admit you need a side job. And it makes me happy to hear you talk so openly and candidly about and lovingly about the side job you needed when you were starting.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the fact that I got at the end of the day, and even now, where you know, I think if you look at Twitter and you look at LinkedIn and you look at all the venues that writers use to promote their work, they're always promoting the stuff that they are most proud of, which they should. But if you look at my Twitter feed, you would think that the only things I write are for big time for publications that deal with basketball or let me rephrase that. If someone like I've written for the New York Times, I've written for Grantland, and I've promoted those things like to the hilt, but I'm not promoting like the advertorials that I write and the gig that I just did, copy editing a directory for hospitals in New Jersey. I think a lot of writers have stuff that the stuff that writers promote is the stuff that they want to be known by, which is great. But I'm willing to bet there are a lot of writers like me who have a ton of stuff that they just don't really talk about because it's very utilitarian. It just gets you from point A to point B. But there's nothing wrong with that because it's all writing, you know, like it's better than digging ditches. It's better than working in an office answering phones in my mind. Like, you know, it's all part of the same sandbox. Sometimes the sandbox has more toys in it. Sometimes there's a slide. Sometimes, you know, there are more kids in the sandbox and you're all playing together, but you're still playing. Like if writing a business profile or writing a corporate newsletter, it all stems from the same joy, you know, and you have to just remind yourself that, yeah, you know, I'm doing what I love. It's not the ideal thing. It's not a profile or a interview for some fancy glossy, but it's still writing. It's still the thing that you love. So I think a lot of, I would like to think a lot of writers like me, and they use that, they take that germ of love and they carry it with them with every project that they do.
And I wonder when you were first starting too, like how did you, or what was the conversation you were having with yourself that gave yourself permission to do what you're doing,
to leave the job, or just to do this whole borders journalism?
I guess both. Like, what was that conversation like? Because you had grown accustomed, yeah, you know, 4 years at a place, you've grown accustomed to a certain stasis, and yes, you know, at some point or another, you do there's the conversation of giving yourself the permission to do what you really want to do. And some people resist that and other people dive in. I wonder what that dialogue was like for you.
It took me a long, long, long time to have that honest conversation with myself. And I'll tell you who really prompted that, what really got me thinking about that was talking to my dad. My dad isn't someone who kind of makes big gestures or doesn't really talk a lot about, you know, he's very much he'll like, I know what your parents are like, but my dad was always the kind of person where, you know, he'll give you a hand if you're in trouble, but he'll let you do your thing and make your mistakes and learn from them. Mm-hmm. So right a couple months before I quit VRM, my dad called me and said, hey, you know, I want to meet with you for dinner. Which was unusual because my dad never does that. So I meet him at a diner that's near where he lives and where my parents live, and we're sitting down, we exchange pleasantries. And he very bluntly tells me, look, you know, you have to do something. You're miserable. You're making everyone around you miserable. you have to do something. You can't keep doing this. And that was a turning point, because when somebody who by nature doesn't say stuff like that says something to you, addresses you directly and says, look, get your head out of your ass and do something, you take note. And my brother too, my brother Dave, who's actually an editor at Mad Magazine, he was always on me to quit. And he was always saying, you know, look, I'll lend you money. I'll do, you know, I'll whatever you can do, I'll help you. And I had people, it took a long time. It took my dad, it took my brother, it took friends to just sort of tell me, look, you know, you're not happy, for me to realize that. And then there were a number of instances at work where I just realized, and it's funny, there were a few instances at work that all sort of happened in a row. And one of them was the editor asking me to get coffee for some people who were some clients who were visiting. Like, I'm the associate editor of a magazine. I have deadlines to meet. I'm getting coffee. Mm-hmm. That kind of moment, along with the conversation with my dad, my brother keeping that voice in my ear, that really made me think, look, you know, this is just not a path worth following, because, you know, you're not fulfilling your potential and you're not happy. But it took a long time, because you get used to certain things. You get used to 2 weeks vacation. You get used to a steady paycheck. You get used to going in and doing the same thing every day and not having to face surprises. And so, yeah, it was a long conversation with myself. It was a long conversation that others had with me. but it all just clicked in. And as I said, there were a number of instances at work all within the same month where, man, just people were, where you just, where, you know, there was the coffee incident, as I call it. there was, you know, my editor lashing out at me for no real reason, or rather my boss lashing out at me for no real reason. And just me realizing, like, look, this is I've reached the end of the road here. There's nowhere else I can go, so it's time to forge my own path.
It's funny you brought up how your father said you're miserable and you're making everyone else miserable around you. Because I don't know if you listened to The Moment with Brian Koppelman at all.
No, that's something I need to check out, because I have a lot of respect for that guy. He's really sharp.
Yeah, he's sharp. He's just a real champion for artists and people who are trying to get over that fear and resistance to go from zero to one but he, in a lot of his early episodes, and it always kind of crops up here and there, because he was experiencing this and living it. He was about 30 also when he first started writing and wrote Rounders with his with his partner. And but what he said is, like, if you're not, like, in some ways expressing that sort of creative itch, like, you're going to become toxic to yourself and others.
Yeah.
He's definitely. It's a venom that it just will just get to the heart if you don't find a way to get that done. And it, like, you're living proof of that just by what you were saying.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was, he's absolutely right. And that's a really good point. Yeah. I mean, there's no way I'm talking to you. There's no way that I'm writing where I've written or what I'm doing now. If I didn't get that, if I didn't purge myself of that job. And it's this is not to speak ill of VRM, it's not to speak ill of the people there. It was just time. I had spent way too much time there. And it was time for me to go. And the job was affecting me, and it was affecting me in a toxic way, because of time, because of, and I think because I knew deep down that there was more to what I could do than what I was doing. And, but you're absolutely right. There is never in the 10 years I've been freelancing, I've never had a moment where I felt, I don't want to do this. I've never had a moment where I thought, gee, I really wish I were doing something else or pursuing another line of work. I've never felt that way. I'll give you another example. If I'm rambling, please forgive me.
No, go on. This is great.
One of the signs I knew things were really bad was I had a condo that was 10 minutes from where the offices were. And I knew things were really, truly bad when I was getting up at 8:45 in the morning, throwing on whatever clothes I could find, giving my teeth barely a brushing and heading out the door, leaving the apartment at 8:55 to get there by 9, because I just didn't want to go in. And I've never had a moment like that in the 10 years that I've freelanced. I've never had a moment of dread. But when I was working at VRM near the end, I felt like that was just a recurring thing. And yeah, I think there's something to be said for that. I mean, I not once do I think, oh, gee, you know, I really should be, you know, learning air conditioning repair or learning how to drive a big rig. I'm really happy doing what I'm doing.
That's great. What were those first months, first weeks and months like when you started freelancing?
It felt real. You know what it felt like? It felt like getting your driver's license for the first time and someone gives you the keys to the car and just says, drive. That's what it felt. It felt like I just had all this freedom and I felt paroled. It was great. I wasn't really scared. I wasn't nervous. I felt paroled. I felt free. And it was great to sort of just, it was like being stuck in a bad marriage and then divorced and going on the single scene and just like, oh, there's so many options. And it was wonderful. Like it was such a thrill to just sort of be able to try new things and pitch to different places. And it just felt really, really liberating. I look back at it now, it really was a special time. It was just something. That's the best way I can put it. It felt really, really liberating. And I'm not sure if I felt that way since, nor should I, because, you know, it's the first time. You know, you're not going to have that feeling every day. So, right. But yeah, liberating.
There's this sliding scale thing. So like when you were first starting, of course, like you had like 40 hours of borders and you squeeze in your the writing around that. And then over time, it's like you're able to maybe like scale back some of that borders work and then you're upping the writing stuff, the writing to fill up some of the time. And I wonder, like, when did those two spots along that spectrum get real close? And then when did the one surpass the other?
Okay, that's a good question. What happened was, it's funny. This is where there should be another blog post on this because this is the story kind of takes a turn. let's see. I was working the border. This is around May 2008 is when it really kind of changed, because what happened was the borders had closed and I was writing more. I'd gotten a few more gigs here and there. I was busier writing, and I was working at Barnes and Noble in the about 10 minutes from my house, just working in the back room, which was great. Oh, that was so much fun, just unloading boxes and putting shelving stuff. The guys in the back room were just the best, and it was so much fun to hang out with them. So I was enjoying myself there, and then a friend of mine who worked at Barnes and Noble for a division called Quamet, which came out with a series of instructional guides, like laminated how-to guides. She reached out to me and said, "Hey, you know, we're hiring somebody to be like an assistant editor there on a freelance basis. Would you be interested? It's a full time. It's a year long job. Would you be interested in that?" I said, "Yeah, great. I'm totally down." So I interviewed for it. I got the position, and then that's when I left retail and started writing full time. of course, back then it was not funny, was the getting that my getting the job coincided right with the Great Recession of 2008. So a 12-month job became a 3-month job. And then that was a whole other story. But wow. But from that point on, I decided, you know, I was writing I was writing, or at least trying to write. Yeah.
How did you weather that that little storm there of thinking that you had the 12-month gig that it got reduced down by 75%?
Poorly. I'll be honest with you. Poorly. And this is one thing I learned, and I'll put this down in the next if the public wants to endure another one of these how-to lists. I panicked. What happened was the job came to a close. I lost two other really, really dependable freelance gigs in that same time, and I panicked. What happened was I was out of. There really wasn't anything happening for like 9 months. So I was, oh man, like I was applying online for stuff all the time, full time jobs, freelance jobs. Then at one point, I'd say about 8 months in, I just said, fuck it. I'm just going to go freelance. I'm going to freelance all the way. And then I got a job. It was a terrible job, but it paid. As a community editor for three community magazines in Central Jersey. So that held me over. But those 9 months were really bad because I didn't know how to get work in that situation. I was looking at online ads all the time, and that was a mistake. I should have been reaching out more personally. I should have been writing more pitch letters. I learned from that experience just not to panic, just to stay the course, take a step back, see what needs to get done, and just, take it step by step. But I think like everybody else, I was just overwhelmed, and I did not handle it well, not at all. It was not a good stretch, but my family helped me out. My now wife was extremely supportive at the time. Because I'm not sure many people would date somebody who had, zero career prospects and whose bank account was just, close to zero. So it was not a good time, but I learned a lot from it for sure.
What was your, when things are really humming for you, like what is your query routine or your pitch routine? Like how many are you crafting at a time, sending out per day or per week, or what's that routine like for you?
It varies. I would say about on a good week, 2 to 3. And they're always one, like I'm looking at my board right now. I have a giant board I keep track of everything. Right now I have about 5 or 6 pitches out right now. There's a pitch that I'm going to send out, probably once I'm done with talking to you, whenever that is. So, I'd say about 2 to 3 pitches or queries a week. And it can be anywhere from just a pitch letter, a simple pitch letter, typical pitch letter, to reaching out to an editor I know and just sending a 2-sentence email like, hey, I have an idea for this, and going from there. And that's the fun part now, is that as you get to know editors, the querying process is less daunting. I can just write to an editor, to my editor, let's say by Sports or Hoop or wherever, and just say, hey, I have an idea to do this. And the editor says yes or no. And then you're on to the next thing. So I'd say 2 to 3 a week is a 2 to 3 a week. More if I can, because, you always want to keep irons in the fire.
Yeah. What does that board look like? How big is this, this draft board, if you will?
This board is, oh my goodness, like it's a dry erase board. I would say it is 2 feet long by a foot high, and I have it just, it's in categories. It's something else. Like there's stuff, it's organized into places I can pitch, that where editors will, I know that editors won't kick me to the curb or ask who the hell are you. There's a section that's devoted to deadlines, 4 or 5 deadlines at a time, when they're due, so I can see them. There are pitches that are in the – I have an area that's devoted to pitches that I'm monitoring. And right now there are about, I'd say, a dozen. There are plans for 2016. And then there's also a giant list, I'd say, of 60-65 ideas that I have that I want to write about at some point. They're just, it's in my like childish scrawl. Like there's just, some of them can't even read it. It's just, will be a word like, you know, sisters, and then I have to figure out like what the heck that means. But yeah, it's a big board. I used to, yeah, it's just easier to me to look at everything that way. It's easier to keep track.
Do you color code things so it's easy to look at a glance?
Yeah, I'm a color code fiend. Like, I also have a daily planner, a monthly planner, and that's color coded. Yeah, I mean, it's insane. Like, there's like five or six colors involved. You would take a look at it and think I'm nuts, because it's just, oh, like deadlines have a color, pitches have a color. It's arts and crafts time over here. It's something else.
It's tremendously helpful to see at a glance. Like, you can see if you have, I don't know how, like, if your deadline color is like red or something, like you could just look at a glance and see like blood on your on your calendar. You'd be like, oh man, I better step up my game right now. Things are getting urgent.
I go for a more soothing color. I go with pink.
All right.
Pink. I don't know why pink became the de facto deadline color. It just did. Phone conversations are orange. If I'm going out to interview somebody, or if I'm going out somewhere that's yellow, purple is a pitch. It's something else. Like, there's no red. I use red to cross out the days. Like, that's like the conqueror. Like, it's just, we've mowed down another day. Let's go to the next thing. I'm a big color coding guy. And really with freelancing, it's a lot of it is organization, you know, just, keeping track of things and just keeping an eye on when to reach out to people and when you're spinning plates. I think, you know, that's what this is. You know, there are 10 plates that need to be spun, and you're doing your best not to have a plate drop and shatter. So
are most of your stories, do you do a lot of your features and stuff like over the phone, or are you one of these guys who's able, or you're able to travel a lot too, or do you keep a pretty much a home base? And
yeah, it's a home base, but it's a home base. And I'll let me be clear. I wish it weren't. I think it's always better to do stories in person, because you get so much more color that way. So if I can, I want to try and go out and interview somebody at home. But again, a lot of my stuff is for national publications or websites that have scope. So yeah, I mean, I can't, you know, in Ithaca, there isn't a lot going on around here. So a lot of it is phone, but I try to go out and do on the scene reporting when it's possible. I mean, I did something for the New York Times, a couple months ago on Ted G. Newell's The San Diego Chicken. And, that, you know, so I flew out to Des Moines, Iowa for that. And that and that made the story so much better. I mean, but when you do stories on the phone, the key that I've found is to interview as many people as humanly possible, so you can get the color so you can get the color, because other people can fill in the blanks. They can tell you things, because if you talk to one person or two people or three people, you're not going to get that personal feel. So when I do stories that are multi-source over the phone, I'm calling as many people as I can. Just makes the story. I think the stories are better for it.
Right. And usually, when you're talking to a source for a story of that nature, when you're done, do you usually just ask them, be like, "Hey, who else should I speak to about this?" Just to get an extra domino.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that's my standard operating, that's how I end every phone conversation with, "Hey, who else could I talk to?" You know, I'm trying to, because again, if you're curious and you're genuine and you want to know more about the subject, people will volunteer a source, you know, because they want the story to be true. They want it to stand out. So that works 99% of the time. And every story that I've written that I'm proud of has that element of someone else saying, "Yeah, you know, try this person, try that person," and you eventually you when the names start repeating, that's when you stop. That's when you kind of know you've made the round, so to speak.
What does your maybe the first hour to 2 hours of your day look like as you're gearing up and as you wake up and get going?
Yeah, I mean, typically what I do is I'm up. It's really going to change because my wife and I are expecting my wife is due to give birth to our daughter in, oh boy, the Sunday after Thanksgiving. So this routine may be completely different by the time this podcast runs.
Yeah. Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we're thrilled.
Is it your first?
Yeah, it's our first. It's our first. Yeah. So it's it's going to be real interesting to see how this routine. It's just going to be. I think it's going to be pell mell for the first 18 years. So typically what I like to do is I get up with my wife because she's a professor at Ithaca College. So her day starts early. So I'm usually up with her around 7. We have breakfast. We talk about our day or what we want to do, just basic stuff like, okay, well, I'll get this, you get that. Then I go downstairs to my office. I have we have a finished basement in our house, which is devoted to my office, which is great. It's huge. It's more than I deserve. So, and typically what I'll do is I'll answer emails, I'll check job sites, I'll check Twitter. There's a routine that, that's what I'll do. I'll look at my schedule, see what has to be done. I might do a little bit of writing. I might send out a pitch, but that first hour or two, really does affect the rest of the day. I think if you have a good first hour, the rest of the day is terrific. If it's a bad first hour, the day is pretty much hot garbage. I don't know why that is, but it's important for freelancers. I think for anyone who's starting to freelance to realize like, that's okay. Like if you have a bad day, if you have a day where you don't get half the stuff done, it's okay. There's tomorrow. You're being a freelancer and is having flexibility. So maybe Monday was bad, but okay, maybe Monday night will be better. Maybe you have some time to carve out to send some emails or to write a pitch. So it's important not to get down about how the day ends up, because every time that when you rue like, oh, I should have done this, I should have done that, you can't get it back. So you pack up, you think about what you need to do for tomorrow, and you get it done the next day. You just can't do it every day. You have to just give yourself that mulligan and then start fresh tomorrow.
So how do you balance, say, like the more high churn, low pay work with stuff that might pay better but like takes more time to work on?
The key to that is starting the passionate work early. Mm-hmm. so it doesn't become super inconvenient. Like I'll give you an example. I wrote a piece for Rolling Stone on Salem Sportswear, which was this really innovative, very stylish sports apparel company that came out, that was big in the 80s, and they sort of really redefined how the NBA marketed itself in terms of individuals. They were big on caricature shirts, where you had, let's say Isaiah Thomas, and it was just Isaiah Thomas and a big head and dribbling a basketball. It really revolutionized how really revolutionized sports apparel, made it more personal. So with that story, I started that. I pitched the Rolling Stone, they accepted it, and I think I started it in February, and I don't think it ran until May. So I typically work on this stuff like months in advance, because that way you can work on it in dribs and drabs, and then you can do the high priority, higher priority stuff more easily. So let's say, for example, I have a corporate client that needs an article done on Tuesday. Like I can work on that while making the phone calls for the story, reporting, doing all the things that need to be done. It's easier to manage. So the key is to just start the passionate stuff. Give yourself a lot of lead time. That way you have the time, you have the chance to make it right. And also when it's a slow period, you can work on that low priority stuff. So it really is a balancing act. So that's what I try to do. I try and just give myself a ton of time that I can make all those phone calls. I can do all the edits, and I can do that while working on the higher priority stuff.
What are some other gigs that people might not necessarily think of when they think freelance writing or freelance journalism?
That's a good question. And that's something that I think I think a lot of people fall prey to. Like they really want to focus on their interests, which is great. They should. That's why you get into freelancing. You know, I don't think anyone is getting into freelancing due to the same work they were doing before. But there is this trap where you only want to write film stuff or environmental stuff, or you know, and then by doing that you miss out on the stuff that you need to keep your fingers flowing and to put money in your pocket. So, and there are some great places to start. Like college magazines are always great. I think that's really an untapped market. And I've done some writing for a few of them. Let's see, there's that. That's always a big one. Local magazines, local like A&E magazines. There are a ton of them, like in the city near you. Like if you go, I remember going into Princeton, which is probably the coolest city near East Brunswick, and grabbing every free weekly that was I could find, and came across one that I'm still writing for now, which is Icon, which is based in New Hope, and I've been writing for them for God, 10 years now. So local publications, even newspapers, if you're into arts and entertainment writing, there's always free weeklies like that. College magazines are really good. Another thing to do, and this is going to sound really rudimentary, is instead of throwing out the phone book, keep the phone book, go into the yellow pages and look to see what publishers are in the area. What magazines are in the area? Because I found a gig in Ithaca, which is where I am now, by doing just that. You know, oh, this is what's Momentum Publishing? Oh, they're cool. So I wrote a letter to the editor there, and I've been writing for them for about 6 months. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I mean, also going on job boards, going on places like Journalism Jobs, freelance writing gigs. Craigslist is also good if you can smell out the scams, and there are plenty of them. Oh, brother, there are so many of them. So also just word of mouth, telling people like, hey, I'm writing. Hey, I'm freelancing now. Not just people that you've worked with, but family and friends. You know, you never know when something comes up. So those are a few avenues, and I'm sure I'm forgetting some, but those are four or five really good starts. You have to just mix it up. You can't just rely on one thing, because you're never going to find work just going down one road. You have to use five or six. It's like a quarterback reading routes. Like, okay, well, the first wide receiver is covered. Okay, well, where's my secondary? You have to know where each receiver is on the field.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I wonder too, like, what as you kind of wrap things up, because I want to be respectful of your time.
No, I have plenty of time. Whatever you need to ask me, I'm here.
Cool. Well, let me ask you, like, what is your proudest moment so far as a freelance writer? It's just maybe that one, that first big byline, or just one that really you really hang your hat on. Like, what makes you smile when you reflect on that?
In 2013, I wrote getting into Grantland, writing for Grantland. I know it's a shame that website is gone, because that was such a great website, and you could just get everything there, and the talent level was just through the roof. And writing for Grantland, writing a 2,500 word feature, getting it published, and then seeing that I'm with being on the same, just in the same site with like Jonathan Abrams and Wesley Morris and
Andy Greenwald these guys. Yeah.
It was like what the hell am I doing here? Like, what this is like, you know, it's like, you know, what planet is this? How did I and that was the moment I felt like, yeah, I can run with these guys. I mean, I may not get into every play, but I can run with these guys, and I can do good work at the best places. And that was one of those moments that was just that really just that really made me that I'm probably proudest of, was just the first big feature I had done was for Grantland, and just getting in there and just seeing it on the site and the feedback, that was amazing. And that was a feeling that I want to, and that's a feeling you hold on to, because it was incredible. I had no, a few months later, getting in the Times, getting the New York Times, getting the front page of the sports section on the Wednesday was,
wow.
It was so gratifying, because you don't think, I never thought I would be in these places. I never thought I would be writing for the Times or writing for Bill Simmons's site. I mean, a guy that I used to waste my lunch hours reading because he was like my only salvation. Like, oh, Bill's writing. Let me read what he has to say. Oh man, it was surreal. And that's the thing I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose that sense of wonder and that sense of just being genuinely touched by something like that. And even when I write a story, I never want to lose that curiosity. I never want to lose that thrill, because it's when that gets old, then maybe I should start looking for something else to do, but it hasn't yet.
Oh, that's wonderful. I think that's a perfect place for us to end on right now, Pete. One last thing. Where can people find you online?
People can find me online. Probably Twitter is the best bet. And that's just my name. It's Pete Croato, C-R-O-A, two T's as in Thomas O, @ Pete Croato. And I have a blog. I have the link to my Tumblr is there, and I update that occasionally. At some point, I hope to have a proper website with clips and a bio and contact information. But right now the Twitter is where I'm doing most of my business, and I've had no problems there. So yeah, Twitter's the best bet.
Fantastic. Well, we'll have to at some point or another when the dust settles from you becoming a newly minted father, we'll have to have maybe a round two where we talk about some of the other stories you've written instead of just this real granular talk on freelancing.
No, I'd be happy to. And if hopefully I'll be more coherent the next time around. So
this was incredibly insightful and entertaining. And it's good for me to hear every now and again, because just in this biz, as you know, sometimes it's easy to get bogged down and a bit demoralized. So like hearing you talk about it and your practice and how you've grown from zero to where you are now is it's really inspiring for me. And I know it'll be inspiring for anyone who chooses to spend an hour with us talk about this stuff.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I mean, Jeff Perlman says it best, you know, writers help writers. So I think, you know, and there are so many people who have helped me, so many, you know, whether starting from journalism school, starting from college through my first jobs to even now, writers help writers. So I'm happy. So if anything that I say helps anybody, that's fantastic. So I'm happy to do this.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again, Pete. And we'll certainly be in touch down the road. Thanks again for your time.
You got it, Brendan. Take care. Thanks so much.
You got it. Talk to you later.